This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Scientists around the world who study endangered whale sharks have been enlisting the help of citizen scientists to gather important data. A growing number of eyes and ears on and under the water have submitted photos and information to a new Wild Book for Whale Sharks. Researchers say their reports have made it easier to study these elusive animals, and they're sharing that data for the first time in a study that's being published today in the scientific journal Bioscience. We're joined later this hour by one of those researchers, Dr. Robert Huter. He is the director of the Center for Shark Research at Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium in Sarasota. But first, University of Florida researchers say that half of the insects, reptiles, arachnids, and crustaceans that come into the United States come in through Florida ports. So it's little surprise that Florida also has the most invasive species of any state in the country. In an effort to identify invasive species or insects before they become prolific, the University of Florida Institute for Food and Agricultural Studies has created the Florida First Detectors Program. The idea is to train stakeholders like Florida master gardeners, nursery managers, and farmers to identify invasive pests using tools like the new Invasive Species or Insects Identification Guide, co-authored by Dr. Amanda Hodges. Dr. Hodges joins us now. Thanks for talking with us today.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
It's great to have you. And here on the edge of the Everglades, the biggest invasive, both in size and impacts, is the Burmese python, which has become an apex predator in its non-native environment. One of the leaders in the snake's removal is the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, and we're joined now by the Conservancy's wildlife biologist and science coordinator, Ian Bartosik. Ian, thanks for coming on the show again.
Hi, Julie. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you back, and I look forward to hearing the stories of your python nuts. And our final guest is Sean Brunel. He's a campus naturalist at Florida Gulf Coast University, and he often works in the environment where these invasives tend to thrive. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Oh, happy to be here.
We're talking about Florida's invasive pests and reptiles, and you can join this conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Dr. Hodges, what qualifies a species as invasive? Are all non-native species considered invasive?
That's a great question. Not all non-native species are invasive. But we do have at least two new insects approximately a month that come into Florida and set up their residency, much like we have many incoming visitors that visit Florida and also come here for the winter. And whether or not some of these insects will become invasive, sometimes we don't know until after they're a problem, either at somebody's home or maybe in an agricultural or natural area.
What are some of the more common invasive insect species that we see here in Florida?
That's a great question. We've seen a number of, scale insects and mealybugs, particularly in South Florida over the years. And many of the homeowners listening may be familiar with the pink hibiscus mealybug, which was an invasive that came up kind of through the Caribbean pathway, where it was already in the Caribbean islands first before it arrived and established in South and Central Florida.
Yeah, I just gave a knowing nod because it took out one of mine. So at what point does an invasive species just become part of the environment? Or once it's invasive, is it always invasive? Do they ever kind of blend in?
That's another excellent question. Many times we see particularly whiteflies that will come into South Florida that are not native to the South Florida area. And we had several problems with whiteflies knocking out ficus plants and other hedgerow plants. And over time, we do often see that these insects may be controlled or managed through other natural enemies that are already in the environment. But sometimes they just become so problematic that an entire plant is no longer in the landscape. An example of this would be we see far fewer cycads in the landscape than we did historically 10 to 15 years ago because of the Asian cycad scale.
Oh, okay. Well, that's kind of the problem here with I'm going to turn now to Ian. His specialty is in bigger invasives, and we hear frequently about the chill-inducing pythons. They don't really have any natural predators here, do they?
Well, actually, as they get primed into our ecosystem, American alligators will predate upon them, and we've even found that eastern indigo snakes will eat invasive Burmese pythons.
Ooh, really?
Mm-hmm. That's
well, that's
cool.
Good news. I didn't know that. I thought they just didn't have anybody.
Score one for the good guys.
Yeah. Are they the biggest issue facing Southwest Florida right now?
Well, I'm a little biased, but I got to say, this is the poster child for invasive animal issues here. I mean, this is one of the largest snakes on the planet, get close to 20 feet in excess of 200 pounds. And the impact they're having across the greater Everglades system, you got to see it to believe it. It's the real deal. And this is one of the main issues we're facing right now. There's a host of non-native invasive plants and animals out there, but this is the one. This is the one that's affecting South Florida and is expanding its population into central portions of the state, and we'll see where this animal can get to.
I'm sure you heard about it, but we did a story about a guy that was in he's researching mosquitoes, and he's found that because there's a lack of prey animals for the pythons to eat, they've kind of eaten everything out there, that all we really have left are these little field mice, these mice.
Sure, I think they're cotton mice or cotton rats.
So the cotton rats, and those are the ones that are host to these one particular mosquitoes, and that mosquito carries a disease, and then once those mosquitoes get into human areas and they get out of the Everglades, they could spread a pretty serious disease.
And once you connect an invasive species to a human threat, then maybe some money can trickle down to deal with that problem. But what's interesting of that study as well is those animals on the eastern Everglades, there isn't much left to eat on the mesomammal scale. So they're resigned to eating small rodents and maybe into alligators. Over here on our western southwest portion of the state, the animals we bring in for necropsies, we're still seeing some of our native wildlife in there. And it's the real deal. It's changing. When you're ready, I'm going to show you a photo here of what we found in a Burmese python. And it's pretty impactful. You'll have to describe it for your listening audience.
I'm going to brace myself. So Ian brought in a photo.
All right,
you
ready?
On the front is a photo that's – ew.
All right. There's some things you can't unsee.
Oh.
And this is a small Burmese python. It's 30 pounds, and it is regurgitating a fawn, a deer that's 35 pounds. It's a 31-pound python, 35-pound fawn. This is an animal that is ingesting something that's 111% of its body weight.
And I'm thinking back to Thanksgiving just last week. Talk about overstuffing yourself.
Yeah. So on the Day in the Life of the Research Project, we have a research collaboration going on in South Florida for the last 5 years, Rookery Bay, Naples Zoo, Cuyahoga Seminole. And this was a python that we were following with a radio tag transmitter. And when I saw this, a Day in the Life of this research project, I was sold on the impact that this animal is having on our native wildlife. This is panther food. You know, we have endangered Florida panther, and this animal is competing for the resources, and quite likely out there somewhere a python has already eaten a panther. It just hasn't been documented yet. So,
yeah, that's so good.
Got to see it to believe it.
I've never been a big fan of snakes so much, and I've never been a fan of these pythons, but that just now definitely turned up. I have very, very little sympathy for. So tell me a little bit about your project that you've been doing, and you've been doing this for a while, and it's kind of a tough sell because it's trying to
really
get people to not just go out and wholesale slaughter, but to actually track them.
Well, let me just back up for a second. Snakes get a bad rap, literally. And we have 15 species of native snake in the state of Florida, and they all provide a tremendous ecological service. We have one of these largest snakes on the planet that's introduced and invasive and is wreaking havoc. You'll hear a lot of things coming across the airwaves about hunts and pythons and newfangled things. This has been a concerted effort for 5 years using snakes to find snakes. This animal it's almost undetectable to try to locate a Burmese python. So basically what we do is we catch male adult pythons, outfit them with radio transmitters, and have been following them for the better part of 4 or 5 years now, and they lead us to the breeding females. So this lovely visual aid here that may be hard to describe.
It looks like a giant tray of dinner rolls.
Dinner rolls is a good one. I always hear baked potatoes. But basically, this is an average clutch size of eggs laid by a Burmese python. And there's 40-something eggs here. That's the average size. And we're trying to find these female snakes before they have a chance to lay these eggs, their egg layers, and then incubate them for a couple months and hatch all these out into the wild.
Is that why you're just tracking the males?
Yes.
So the females don't have a chance to...
Yep. We're after the females, but... And so keep in mind, this is a small area here outside of Naples. Study area is about 20, 25 square miles.
Are they only doing that here in this area?
It's labor intensive and, you know, it's hard. You need to be mindful of this animal and understand where it's taking you. So, yes, this is the only place that I know of where they're doing it. But our crew, a team of three researchers and some of our partners have removed 4 tons of python from a 25 square mile area in Collier County. Just think about that for a second. 4 tons of python, 25 square miles. Imagine how prolific they are outside of that area. And then these animals are expanding their range. They're moving their way into Lee County, seems like a pincher movement. They're coming from the south, coming from the eastern side, and they're interested in the native wildlife. So if you're squeamish hearing this and it's freaking you out, they're not interested in us. They don't seem to be interested in our pets, but it's a large apex predator, and it's something we need to deal with.
Yeah. So, Dr. Hodges, I want to turn back to insects. I mean, you can't really put a tracker on a white fly. So how are you able to get ahead of figuring out where these guys are?
Sure. The insects are quite a bit smaller than the pythons, so there is certainly a size difference there. But we really want people to be observant, to report something that seems unusual. You know, actually, the first detection of the pink hibiscus mealybug, that particular pest, that was actually a homeowner that reported they saw something unusual. And so it's helpful to have these reports come in early. And a lot of times the insects not only affect things in the natural area and the landscape, but it affects our agriculture as well. For example, I'm sure you've heard of citrus greening disease, which is vectored by an insect, a psyllid. And so it's pretty important, if at all possible, to kind of stop these insect pests before they become more of a problem.
Yeah, and just yesterday I talked with a citrus researcher on this show, and we talked about invasive pests. And he said, you know, it's the IFA Citrus Research and Education Program, and he said that a lot of times you're able to find, they can go back to the country of origin of some of these invasive pests and find their natural predator there and import them. I mean, they haven't found the one for the psyllid, but for other insects, I think there was one that spread a canker that they were able to do that with. But whenever you introduce another insect from an invasive pest hometown, can that new predator that's been introduced eventually become a problem?
Well, it certainly could become a problem, but we have such extensive regulation now in terms of what happens with the release of a new insect if it's not from here. It goes through a series of research trials in a highly secured quarantine laboratory before anything is ever released. And so we haven't had really problems with kind of biological control going wrong recently because we do have more regulations in place to prevent it from affecting non-target species.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as we mentioned before, you can't really put a tracker on a fly. So is that why this Florida First Detectors program is so important? It's involving a number of agencies. Who else is working on it?
Right. You're right. It is important because you can't put a tracker on them. And a lot of these insects are very difficult to identify and look similar to species that we already have in Florida. So that's why we're encouraging people to report. We have the Division of Plant Industry, Florida Department of Agriculture, involved, as well as the United States Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, Plant Protection and Quarantine, and also our statewide Cooperative Agricultural Pest Survey Program, our statewide CAPS program. And that's actually a program where people are, as part of their daily job, just surveying for some of these exotics. But even with all of the survey efforts that we have, it's just not enough given the number of insects that could be a problem to our agriculture and natural areas.
So the Florida First Detectors program, is that going to provide some sort of training for master gardeners and stakeholders like we mentioned earlier in the show?
Yes, we've actually been training people in this program since 2013. And so we've had a number of events and hosted at different counties around the state. We've got a few coming up in 2018 as well.
Okay. And then, Ian, I wanted to turn back to you for a second. We're talking about, you know, the bringing in the things that would eat these invasive bugs. Mm-hmm. And you said earlier that there are a couple things that are predators for pythons, just a couple. But are there any –
Sure.
They come from Burma. What keeps them in check in Burma?
This is a different beast. Well, first off, they're endangered in Burma. They're a threatened species. We probably have more Burmese pythons in South Florida than they do in Southeast Asia.
How'd that work out?
I'm probably overhunting for the leather industry or meat, but our Everglades system is expansive. It'd be hard to get them all out of there. You know, and let me just back up for a second. The program that Dr. Hodges is talking about, that's very proactive. That's being on the front lines. That's getting these animals before they get established. The snake, the python's out of the bag. That's the one that got away from us, and that's our learning lesson there. So I commend them for those results and getting, you know, we need people on those front lines looking, making sure that these new pests aren't coming in from our ports of entry that she mentioned.
For sure, but then, I mean, we can be trained all day long, but pythons are good hiders.
Oh, yeah.
So I mean, is there any possibility of making their – I don't know. Nobody wants to eat them really here. What kind of predator can we have that can get these guys?
Sure. The way I look at it is the research that we're doing is we're looking for a weakness that we can use to exploit this animal. They're ectothermic, cold. They're cold sensitive. They lay eggs and the females stay with those eggs for a couple of months out of the year. So we're looking for those kind of weaknesses where we can target them and make them more detectable. But ultimately – some smart weapon needs to be developed. We got to work smarter, not harder on this, because we can send every python hunter on the planet out there in the woods and you'll still be hard-pressed to police these animals up. I feel like a good analogy would be that the greater Everglades ecosystem, the living organism that it is, has an infection on some of the python. They're infected with pythons and there's no antibiotic. It's systemic at the moment and we're waiting for something to be able to be deployed to use to get these animals on a landscape level. We're kind of just holding the line right now, raising awareness. That's why people also need to be observant and call in these sightings, take a photo. And much like they're reporting these animals they see in the first detector program, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission monitors a hotline. And they also have an app for the smartphone, the I've Got One app. Mm-hmm. So you can get familiar with those non-natives, take a photo, call, report the location and log that information in, and they can send a responder. If you're so inclined, you can also get involved with your CISMA, your Cooperative Invasive Species Management Area, and you would Google Southwest Florida CISMA if you're here in the Southwest, and there's a CISMA in many parts of the states, and they can point you in the direction where you can get in the fight.
Yeah, we need to get somebody to figure out how to make python skin a fashion accessory or something again, or some just so that you can get people to really want to get out there and get after them. Because there is just, like you said, there's not really much that takes them out.
Right. Or if you value your native wildlife, you'll get involved in this effort to raise awareness of invasive animals and get involved and try to help us remove these animals. Or much like with the First Detector Program, call out something that's not supposed to be here. So mm-hmm. An entomologist or somebody can get on top of that.
The kind of research that you're doing is really valuable. We're talking about Florida's invasive pests and reptiles. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCU. So, Sean, I want to turn to you now. You're a student at Florida Gulf Coast University, but you're also a campus naturalist. That's not an on-campus job at most universities. So what is it that you do?
So basically, like you said, we're students, and we're here to help bridge the connection between the campus community and, the students,
and we're here to and the natural environment.
Yeah, we're
right?
to show them what we have on campus, our local ecosystem, and here to connect them to Florida's wild side.
So you guide students; you take them out and show them the nature and the trails on campus and on site at some environmental organizations that the university partners with. Can you walk us through a little bit of what a nature tour on campus is going to be like?
Yeah, of course. So every class is a little different. That's what makes colloquium so unique, but. Basically, on a campus tour, we're going to start on campus and talk about the sustainability efforts that we have here on FGCU, such as the LEED programs for some of our buildings and also the solar panels on the trash cans. And eventually, that leads off to the campus trails, where we go over some of the many ecosystems we have here on campus, Okamics, things like that. And then to end it all off, we go on the ever-so-popular wet walk into the cypress swamp. And so.
Yeah, that's fun. It's an adventure. Do you ever see any invasive species when you do any of those things?
Yeah, we don't really see much animals come in a big group of people, so animals get really spooked from us coming through. Yeah. But we see lots of plants. They don't really move. But we see two specific invasives that we see a lot. We see Caesar weed, especially now after the hurricane that came through, caused a lot of disturbed areas. And Caesar weed's an invasive plant that can come in, take advantage of this open opportunity to grow. And then another one would be Melaleuca trees. It's a great talking point when talking about human impact on our native ecosystem. And they're all both there on campus. And so,
are the students that you take out on these tours, are they usually surprised to hear about some of these invasives? Or did they ever think about it before?
Yeah, usually they're surprised. A lot of students will go out there on the tour on the trails themselves. It's right next to the student living housing, so they can just walk to it. And so they don't even recognize that some of these plants that are right behind them literally don't actually belong here. They're invasives. And so pointing them out to them really kind of shows them that, like, they're all over the place and that they can go completely unnoticed.
It's more of a real human impact than maybe they had realized because, you know, also a lot of times the students that are here are not from here, so they haven't been raised with it, right?
That's exactly true. I mean, just to show them what Florida's wild side looks like and to show them the things that technically don't belong and how that could be a problem in the future.
So, Dr. Hodges, do you see an application for your guide to be used in nature tours like the one that Sean's talking about here on campus?
Oh, absolutely. I think it would be quite useful. And we do have in the deck some species that are already established and in Florida, as well as some of the ones we're on the lookout for. So I think it would be of interest. And in particular, we have, I just wanted to add to what was said earlier related to the helpline. We have a helpline listed in the deck, and that's actually the Division of Plant Industry helpline, which is a number that people can use anytime they think they've seen an invasive species, because sometimes if it's detected early enough, the species can actually be eradicated, and then we can avoid things like the python problem.
Yeah. So how do people get involved if they do want to learn more about what the First Detectors program is about, if they want to go for training, or if they just want to have some of the materials in front of them so they know what they're looking at?
Sure. We have a list of workshops upcoming and past workshops on our website. They can also contact me directly, or I have a couple of staff members also listed on the website that they can contact, and we can directly connect them with some of these materials. And coming up soon, we'll actually have a lot of these materials available as online modules that should be available by the beginning of next year.
Okay, and we have links to that on our website at wgcunews.org. Just click on the Gulf Coast Live tab. Also, we have a photo of the big tray of not dinner rolls, actual python eggs that Ian brought in. And I wanted to shift away from pythons. I know, Ian, we talk about the pythons a lot because that's really kind of your main area. Mm-hmm. But before we went on the air, you said that there is kind of like a hierarchy of threats. There's the python at the top, which is the biggest deal. Who else is in that top four category?
Sure. If we're talking about, let's just say, the inland environment, we're not talking about lionfish off the coast or things like that. In my humble opinion, we have some large lizards that we need to be aware of. We have the Nile monitor lizard. There's been a population of Cape Coral in southwest Florida for the last 20 years. We want to make sure that that population doesn't jump out of there and get in the conservation lands. And then there's the Argentine black and white tegu, pretty popular as pets. You're still able to have them. But there's two breeding populations in the wild, Hillsborough County and then a population in Miami-Dade County. And we see a few pop up on the radar in Collier, but that's an egg eater. Both of these animals are ecologically impactful. They eat native wildlife and they're problematic. But in the interest of time, one that homeowners should be aware of is our amphibian, the cane toad, giant toad, marine toad.
Does it get called bufo toad or something like that too?
Bufo is the name of the genus.
Okay, but it's a common name. That's all the same guy.
We had some native bufo toads, and that's one thing to keep in mind. We have a lot of native toads that look very similar to the cane toad, but they get really big quick. And they have a toxin in their glands, and if a dog bites them, it can be fatal. So just to cut to the chase, they're here. We're going to have to live with them. They're in the urban environment. It's nothing to freak out about. If you have a dog with prey drive abilities that likes to chew first and ask questions later, you really need to get some avoidance training of that animal, or they need to be rushed right away to emergency vet hospital. I've heard too many reports of these toads killing terrier-type pets and things like that that encounter them in the wild. So that's really important. The python is not – Burmese python is not eating any pets to date, but cane toads are responsible for killing dozens and dozens of dogs.
And I'm wondering, are they toxic to other animals? I mean, I know I don't think cats really hunt toads so much, and I don't think – but, you know, sometimes toddlers get a hold of something or maybe touch something and lick their hand.
I guess in this world anything's possible, but, you know, Australia's having a crazy problem with cane toads now. The cane toads are native to Central South America, and just get online and Google cane toads in Australia and look what they're dealing with. It's like a fire going across the continent, killing native wildlife left and right. We haven't really seen that here, and I'm wondering if our native bufo toads, some of our wildlife is already programmed to respond to that, because many toads have toxic glands on them, but this cane toad, this non-native invasive toad, have some with chemicals that are lethal to pets and such.
I've always thought of Florida as kind of like a lesser Australia, you know, like a small version.
Maybe so.
Yeah, just a little bit. Sean, have you ever run into any of these guys? Have you seen the cane toads or any of these lizards while you're out there on your walks?
I haven't personally seen one out there on the walks over here. Back on the East Coast, where I live, I've seen them for sure. But on this coast, I haven't personally seen one.
Toads?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen the toads. It might be because usually when I go out there with Swash students, it could spook some animals away. Lab students. So.
It was pretty during the rainy season, it seemed like it was a bigger deal.
Right, and that's something to keep in mind with this amphibian and its aquatic life cycle. Until the summer rains come, that's when they're pretty prevalent, and that's when you're most likely to encounter them. But they're here in the urban corridor. Just kind of know your animal. This Argentine tegu has a brumation period where it hibernates briefly, and they kind of go undercover for the winter months, and they pop out in the summer. So,
what do you do if you see these? So you said if you see any of these, I mean, of course, take a picture, note the location, report your sighting, and get on the app. I mean, but do you try to like do anything? Do you try to like?
No,
wrangle them?
I wouldn't, especially with these large lizards. They're pretty bitey. The pythons, they're all going to usually try to run away, or if you corner them, they'll stand their ground. You don't want to wrangle with them unless you've got a little bit of training. And there's programs that are offered that can, if you're so inclined and you really want to jump in the battle, you can talk to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, come to their training sessions, and respond to some of these sightings. But mostly, take a photo. ID is very important. Most of the time, some of these animals are misidentified. There's a lot of lookalikes, especially in the lizard world. We've got iguanas and night anoles and all kinds of lizards. And then the snake, the Burmese python, sometimes people see these small native snakes like corn snakes and they think it's a python. You're very unlikely to see a hatchling-sized Burmese python, which is usually 2 feet after they come out of these eggs, a slender 2 feet. But if it's large and in charge and, you know, over 4 or 5 feet and doesn't have a rattle on its tail, it's probably a Burmese python. And take a picture, note the location. And
how do they act? You said that they kind of like run away, they scurry away. But I mean, once you get it cornered, what do they act like? Do they try to strike out and bite at you? Or
sure.
What?
If you corner them or try to remove them off their egg clutch, they're obviously going to defend themselves, wouldn't we? But we've walked in on thousands of observations on Burmese pythons. And I just got to tell you, at no time were they ever after us. They just wanted to get away. They're a beautiful animal. I mean, they really are when you look at the pattern. I have a lot of respect for this creature, but we understand the toll that it's taking, and so we humanely euthanize them when we find them and remove them from the system. But
have you been bitten by a python yet?
A couple times, you know, pulling them off eggs in a gopher tortoise burrow, and they're pretty quick when they get away from you, and if you don't get behind their neck right away, they can turn around. And here's what the skull looks like.
It's got some teeth in there.
There's 100 teeth on these things.
I mean, they're not poisonous, right?
No, these are constrictors. So they're not venomous. But no arms, no legs. They need these recurved teeth, and they grab and hold on and constrict and gobbling up our native wildlife.
Oh, so they grab. They use their teeth to grab on, hold it in place, and then wrap around.
Yep, and they grab and wrap and.
Have they ever tried to wrap around you before?
Usually when we're handling them over 12 feet, it's always good to have a partner
have
with
a
you
friend.
There because they'll throw a coil.
A friend that you like.
Right. And they'll throw a coil and wrap your arm or your leg, and you get a sense of that. I mean, that pressure that they can generate. It's unreal. It's pretty cool. It's creepy cool. But you'd be amazed at how big of an animal that you can actually – of this apex predator that you can get with your hands and wrangle and throw them in a bag, tie them up, and – on to the next one. I mean, it's pretty crazy. You can't make this up. And if you told us 10 years ago as a biologist that we'd be tracking giant snakes through Collier County, I would have thought you're crazy. So we've been beating the snake drum here for a while, raising awareness. And it's just something to definitely keep tabs on here because they're expanding their range in Southwest Florida. We're going to see more of these animals. And you do need to be proactive like this program you're talking about today.
Yeah.
And you got to get them before they get here and get established. This one's out of the bag.
Yeah. And Dr. Hodges, I want to turn back before we run out of time and ask you just one last question. I mean, do you ever get concerned about too many cooks in the kitchen, so to speak? People maybe misidentifying little bugs because bugs are kind of harder to figure out, I think, than pythons. You don't need reading glasses to see a python necessarily. But do you have a lot of people doing any misidentification?
Yeah, misidentification can certainly be a problem. And that's why submitting a sample is so important. If something is really potentially new to the state and it may have some sort of implication from a regulatory plant health standpoint, then it's really important that sample be sent to the University of Florida so that we can make sure that it's properly identified and confirmed by a specialist, essentially. We even see misidentifications with things like the giant African snail, which is actually included in the deck and under eradication currently in Miami-Dade County, and that's certainly one that we don't want to see established, but that eradication program is going quite well and has been successful. And that's actually the picture you have on your website highlighting today's call is that of the giant African snail. It could certainly cause some damage if that were actually to establish in the Everglades.
Yeah, that's a big snail.
Yeah, it's big, but we still see people confusing it with even beneficial, almost endangered snails. So there's a lot of opportunity for misidentification. Really consulting with the experts is really the way to go once you think you've really found something.
All right, that's a really good point. Ian, did you have another point you
wanted
to bring up?
I just wanted to mention that if you already have a non-native animal and that you can't take care of it, there are solutions other than letting it go.
And, yeah, what if somebody got a pet and they're
right,
like...
if you've got something you can't take care of, the Florida Fish Wildlife Conservation Commission works with their partners and they have a pet amnesty day in different regions. The next one for Southwest Florida is on January 13th at the Naples Zoo. That's where you can surrender an animal. They'll adopt it out. No questions asked. Something to look into if you have an animal like a snake and you can't take care of it, or a monkey or anything weird like that. They've taken – stranger things I've heard that they've taken.
Oh, I've known people that have gotten monkeys as a pet and then it just – man, they just – got old enough and just really turned.
Right. We haven't covered all bases unless we talk about monkeys.
Yeah, it's not fun. Yeah, got to always have the monkeys on the stereo. But yeah, that's interesting to know that there's a pet amnesty. You can turn them over if you find that you've gotten yourself into something you can't really take care of. That's a great idea. Well, we have run out of time, but I want to leave it there for now. But I do have to thank our guest, Ian Bartosek. Thank you so much for coming in, the science coordinator with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and wildlife biologist. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Sean Brunel, FGCU campus naturalist. Thank you so much for your voice on the show. I appreciate it.
I love listening. Glad I was here.
And also Dr. Amanda Hodges, the director of the entomology and nematology department at the University of Florida. Thank you for joining us by phone.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're joined by a shark researcher at the Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota to learn about a new study being released today about the global behavior of endangered whale sharks. It's a 22-year citizen scientist effort that collected photos taken around the world by divers and ecotourists. That story is coming up.